This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you live in the world, you know that piece of music. It is John Williams' iconic theme to Star Wars. Of course, everything about that series of films seems iconic. When filmmaker George Lucas brought the first of his trilogy of films to the screen in 1977, he changed movies and the movie-going experience forever. And he changed expectations of what movies could and should be. Now, we can argue about whether that ended up being a good or a bad thing, but one thing we cannot argue is Star Wars' impact on our culture. As we sat in dark theaters watching an intergalactic battle over which side would control the Force, it electrified our imaginations. Through never-before-seen special effects, memorable characters, humor, and movie-making of epic proportions, we Earthlings bought into the world of Tatooine and beyond, hook, line, and sinker. We also bought into another series of films and spin-offs that weren't necessarily as good as the original trilogy, and we also began buying some of the tons of merchandise associated with the Star Wars saga. In December, The Force Awakens, that's the latest in the series, and it brings back to the screen some of the original characters, older, perhaps wiser. Well, we too are older, so will this film appeal to its original audience? Will it capture a new audience? What has been the enduring appeal of this franchise over the last 40 years? What was it about that film, its story and characters, that so captured our attention and our disposable entertainment dollars? As we wait for The Force to awaken, we look at some of those questions this hour. Adam Frazier is an entertainment journalist and film critic for geeksofdoom.com. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning.
He joins us in our Spirit Square studio along with Dr. Michael Cobry, the Dana Professor of Literature and Chair of the Department of English and Creative Writing at Queen's University of Charlotte, where he also teaches criticism and pop culture. Lest people be wondering, why is a professor of literature on a show about Star Wars? You actually were into pop culture long before you were into literature, right?
That's right. Literature came later. I was a geek first.
So there is hope for those parents who are fretting about the kids in the basement.
Indeed, encourage your children in their geek tendencies. It all turns out well.
And with us by phone is Chuck Wendig, a novelist, screenwriter, and New York Times bestselling author of a new book called Star Wars Aftermath. He is also a Queen's University alumnus and a former student of Dr. Cobry. Welcome to the program, Chuck.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, you're all part of this panel because for different reasons you all have expertise in Star Wars, but I'd like to know if you're all fans of the Star Wars franchise. I mean, you may know a lot about it, but may not necessarily like it. So I'll begin with you, Adam. Fan? Not a fan.
Absolutely. That's the entire reason I'm writing about movies. That's the reason I'm sitting in this studio with you today, is because of Star Wars. So.
Okay. Dr. Cobry.
Sure, I'm a fan. I'm not sure I can tell my tauntauns from my banthas, but I'm definitely a fan. I've seen
about.
The first movies. There we go. We've lost the crowd already. Absolutely.
And Chuck.
No, I hate Star Wars. No, yeah, I was fed on Star Wars. It was my pop culture diet very early on, and the reason I got the job writing the book was, as a fan, I wanted to. I tweeted about it, and I sort of got the job from a tweet.
Okay. Oh, interesting. I think, you put a tweet out saying, I want to write a book about Star Wars you just put it out there to the universe.
Just put it out there.
Help me make that happen, and it happened. Is that just the force of Twitter, or the power of the Twitterverse, or is there something else? It was
the force
with you.
I like to think that I had the force for like 5 minutes. Okay. And it was a lovely bit of serendipity, because I tweeted about it on September 4th last year. And this year, September 4th was called Force Friday, and it's when the book actually came out. So it was a really nice, sort of bookending there for me.
So I take it you can't just write a book about Star Wars. You have to get a special dispensation from Pope George Lucas, right?
Yeah, if you want to try to sell it, although George Lucas is now out of the picture in terms of that stuff. But yeah, if you want to sell it, you should probably get approval.
So you have several successful books to your credit, Chuck, including the young adult Heartland series, and yet this book, Star Wars Aftermath, as I understand this correctly, debuted on the New York Times bestseller list at number 4. This book bridges that gap between The Return of the Jedi, which I think is the last in the Star Wars series up till December, and The Force Awakens, which will be released in December. This is an officially sanctioned Star Wars tale, correct?
Yes, I hope so. Yeah, it's all quote-unquote canon.
So how much you wanted to write a book about Star Wars, you wanted to write a novel, but when you write an officially sanctioned story, you I'm assuming it's like writing for a TV series. You have to know what the characters have done up to now, where the characters are, where the characters will be going in this next film, and there must be a literal Bible on what you can and cannot say and what these characters can and cannot do. How does that affect creativity?
Well, the great thing about working here in terms of Disney and Lucasfilm is that while they have a very clear vision of where their story is going, they also respect the storyteller in terms of letting the storyteller tell a specific story to allow the author to have that voice and have a little control. So mostly what I got was a series of restrictions. I got some characters I could use, obviously, because they're going to save a lot of the big stuff for the film. And I got some sort of situations that I wasn't allowed to talk about, but generally they asked me to pitch them the story. And so what ended up on page was pretty much what I wanted to write.
So if you're writing a bridge between the last Star Wars movie and this next Star Wars movie, you know what happens in this next Star Wars movie, do you not?
I know some of what happens. Yeah, I have. I purposefully stopped digesting that information so I can have some surprises. Like, I know what gets us there.
Yeah.
I know what takes us right up to the start of that film. And I know some of what happens in it because we're referring to some things and planting some seeds and some little secrets and spoilers. But I didn't want to get myself spoiled at the same time. I'm kind of I'm a fan. I want those revelations for my first sit down with the film.
So what does it say to you that this book that you wrote about Star Wars, this novel Aftermath, debuted at number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list? What does that say to you?
Well, it says a lot of things. First of all, it's very exciting to know that people are still into Star Wars. I think this is one of the best times to be a fan of Star Wars. You don't want to be a fan in 10 years or even a writer in Star Wars when it's starting to kind of wane a little bit. Right now, we're really just cresting a wave, some of the most significant Star Wars-driven material that we've seen in a decade or more, possibly ever. And, Disney's really taken a very strong, organic, sort of transmedia-focused look at that. And they're creating kind of a whole new story world and a whole new, it's like going beyond the known galaxy. So it's very exciting for everybody.
At
the same time, it's also nice because, what's that?
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
The book encountered a little controversy early on, and it was nice to see that the controversy didn't actually damage sales and, in fact, possibly move the sales up a little bit.
We'll talk about the controversy because there's controversy surrounding the movie as well. But when Chuck was talking about this is a great time to be a Star Wars fan, you were nodding, Adam, in recognition of that. Why is it a great time in your mind?
Well, a little background. I was born in 84, so I missed the initial crest of the original movies.
Yes, you did.
But I had an older sister who passed down all those toys, and that's how I got into it. So the prequels, unfortunately, were kind of my first real theatrical experience with Star Wars.
Right.
And that's tragic.
Yeah. And, between the special editions and the prequels, being a Star Wars fan over the past 10 years or so has been kind of depressing, But when Disney bought Lucasfilm from George and certain people were put into place like Kathleen Kennedy and J.J. Abrams, there was an optimism. It was literally a new hope for Star Wars in that this can go on and it can be great again. And so
now, since you missed the initial screening of the first Star Wars movie, because you weren't alive then, you say that Star Wars completely changed the way movies are made and distributed. How do you know that, young whippersnapper? You weren't around before Star Wars.
It's true, I wasn't. I've studied a lot, and Star Wars was my gateway into everything. I learned about the filmmaking process and storytelling in general from Star Wars. And, when Star Wars came out in 1977, it was, that was a very cynical decade between Watergate and Vietnam, and people were really dying for escapism, and I think Star Wars came right at the right time along with stuff like Jaws and really revolutionized the blockbuster.
You know, it strikes me.
Sure, you have to change in the release patterns, too. Jaws was the first movie to get a wide release where it opened in hundreds of theaters.
Mm-hmm.
Star Wars followed that, and of course now that's the pattern for all of our modern entertainment franchises.
It's also a movie, I didn't really put this together in my head till I read it someplace yesterday, that it's the first movie to combine genres. It combines science fiction, the Western motif, war films, and quasi-mystical epics.
You've got Samurais, you've got a little bit of The Wizard of Oz when Obi-Wan Kenobi first appears on the screen, a little bit of Tolkien. So absolutely, it's a mashup of all kinds of genres.
Why was George Lucas the first person to do that?
I think George Lucas was at the forefront of a whole generation that was taking over Hollywood and taking over popular entertainment. We can kind of look back at the American films of the 70s before Star Wars, and it is a golden age of American film. Some of the first films of Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, Robert Altman is making great movies as well. And Lucas is a part of that whole movement, but decides he wants to do something that will be entertainment, that will be aimed at a younger audience, that will combine a lot of his passions growing up from old movie serials and comic books and things like that, and stir those all together. He also had a vision, quite frankly, as a businessman, in signing the contract with the first Star Wars movie and making sure that he got the rights to the toys.
Well, part of that was because this is not – I didn't know this either, but I read something you wrote, Adam, that this was not a studio film.
That's right.
An independent – the first Star Wars was an independent film.
Yes. Nobody wanted to touch it. It got passed around and no one was interested, and it took Alan Ladd Jr. at Fox to really believe in George after dealing with him, you know, throughout THX-1138 and American Graffiti to make Star Wars.
And because this one guy, Alan Ladd, came to his rescue and gave him some money to do this, he was allowed to keep the distribution rights on some of these toys that were going to come out as a result of this. Whose idea was it to create these toys? Why would he even think before the film came out that somebody would want R2-D2 on their bookshelf?
You know, that's part of Lucas's vision. He is in a tradition of people like Walt Disney, who are both creators and marketers at the same time, and he understood that from the beginning. When he signed the contract with 20th Century Fox, no one thought that the license for toys was going to be worth anything. The movie would be released in 1977. The toys would begin, by conventional standards, appearing on the shelves months after that. Who would remember the movie at that point, the executives thought? So they thought they were giving away a few points in the contract that were not really worth anything, which of course, proved not to be the case.
Prior to Star Wars, science fiction was treated kind of as an after, like B pictures were science fiction pictures, and they were never funny. This is a funny movie. There were moments of humor in it, and the Earth is always mentioned in science fiction movies, but not in this one.
Yeah, you know, prior to Star Wars, science fiction really came down to the two most successful films of that time were 2001, A Space Odyssey, and Planet of the Apes.
Right.
As you know, 2001, there's really no humor to that movie at all. And it was a very – all those old films are very sterile, clean, antiseptic settings. And Star Wars introduced this idea of a used universe where everything actually feels lived in.
Yeah, this is the first time you've seen dirty space. I mean, the spaceships are not pristine. They're junky, particularly Han Solo's spaceship, kind of a wreck. And it's like an old Toyota or something. We have to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley Arant Bolt Cummings LLP, a full-service law firm whose lawyers are industry professionals experienced in serving the banking and financial services industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation. Details at babc.com. And Signature Healthcare, concierge medicine with offices in Uptown and South Park, providing patients with 24/7 physician access, personalized executive healthcare, and same-day appointments. SignatureHealthcare.org. Sister Simone Campbell has been traveling the country talking about social justice, and that conversation brought her to Charlotte once before for the Democratic National Convention. Well, now she's back for a screening of a film about her efforts. She's one of the nuns on the bus, by the way. She's also been making waves within the Catholic Church, seeking a greater role for women. And Sister Simone Campbell will share her thoughts on a host of issues with us tomorrow morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, new pressures on the Obama administration and Europe to rethink strategies in the fight against ISIS. How the deadly attacks in Paris ratchet up the debate over security, electronic surveillance, and coordinated military action in Syria.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Star Wars this morning because it opens in the new movie. The seventh Star Wars film opens in December. Adam Fraser's with us. He's an entertainment journalist and film critic for geeksofdoom.com. Dr. Michael Cobry is a Dana Professor of Literature at Queen's University of Charlotte. And Chuck Wendig is a novelist, screenwriter, and author of a new book called Star Wars Aftermath, which debuted at number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list. By the way, he'll be in town at the Kettner Auditorium at Queens on November the 19th at 8 p.m. to talk about that book and the Star Wars franchise as well. Lest you think, why are we talking about Star Wars, this silly movie, on a local talk show? It's because, it's affected the entire culture, and we have a professor here to prove that. Absolutely. And I just got a text from a personal friend of mine who is also a professor of humanities and great books and great literature, who wrote me the following just a second ago. It kills me that I have to go into class, but I will listen to the rest of the show tonight. In the summer of 1977, I was trying to make an important life decision. I went and saw the movie 47 times in the old theater at Charlottetown Mall. Believe it or not, for most of my life, I've been a fairly passive person. That summer, Luke Skywalker showed me how to take some kind of control of my life. Believe it or not, I will always love the story, I will always love the characters, and I will be seeing the new movie, but probably not 47 times, at least not until I own the DVD. Talk about that. What is it about this movie that people, grown people, will go see it 47 times? In the parking lot on the way in this morning, the security guard said, "My husband and I have tickets for 2:30 a.m. opening day in the IMAX theater."
Right. Yes. Right. Yes. I think one of the things about Star Wars is it is so radically different from the science fiction films that had come before it. Science fiction, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s in particular, was a B-movie genre. Adam was talking about that a little bit before. So you had smaller budgets and you had lesser-known people in the casts. When you saw movies like Planet of the Apes in 2001 that were clearly A-level pictures with bigger casts, and in the case of Planet of the Apes, bigger stars, those movies always tried to justify themselves by being serious. Planet of the Apes in particular tries to present itself and does present itself as a kind of political allegory. By the time you get to Star Wars, though, George Lucas is just kind of glorying in the pulp roots of this. And I think that's something different in and of itself. I think we also recognize, again, the combination of source material from other films, from comic books, from so many different sources. Certainly, although maybe Lucas added this later on in talking about the influence of Joseph Campbell, the hero with a thousand faces, and a sort of mythic structure that he deliberately wanted to create. Are there a set of political ideas and social ideas that we can derive from Star Wars? I'm not sure about that, and that's really not where I'd go looking for those.
Would there have been a Lord of the Rings series of films? Would there have been Harry Potter films?
Probably not.
Without this?
If we look at contemporary entertainment franchises, look at the genres now that dominate, which are fantasy, science fiction, comic book adaptations. Mm. It's the release of Star Wars in 1977 that puts us on the path to that and moves us away from the path of so many of those other great directors in the 1970s.
So let me ask you, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, one of the things that it really did do is it raised expectations of audiences for spectacle. if you're going to do a film like this, it's got to be the special effects have got to be wonderful. The music's got to be explosively great, like John Williams' score for this. The characters got to be intriguing. It's got to be completely immersive and believable that you've created this world, as opposed to the small little films that are in our galaxy, that are on this planet with interesting stories. This changed everything.
It did, and is that a good thing, a bad thing? I think that depends on your point of view. The type of films that were the mainstream of American films, the cutting edge of American films, say from 1970 to 1976, are now independent films. George Lucas justified his success and the general direction that he pushed American cinema in by saying, well, the success of Star Wars, so many of those funds went to theater owners who were then expanding their theaters into multiplexes. So he would talk to his friends Martin Scorsese and others and say, look, I'm creating a theater for you. There's going to be an auditorium where they can show your film, and that auditorium is being built in part on the proceeds from Star Wars.
Wow.
But certainly it's changed.
How did this impact why you wanted to be a writer, Chuck?
Well, you know, like I said, I started with Star Wars. You know, I was born roughly at the same time. I saw Empire Strikes Back in a drive-in theater. So I've been sort of brining and pickling myself in the Star Wars universe for 30 years. So that first seed is really that. Certainly, you know, as you get older, you start to go past that and you grow beyond Star Wars and you grow beyond kind of the Campbellian mythic structure and you sort of kind of rebel a little bit against it, I guess, somewhat ironically. But that's always the fundamental seed for me is Star Wars.
And you describe yourself as a Star Wars fan from birth, Adam.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So just as there are Trekkies out there, aficionados of the Star Trek TV series and the movies, are there – I'm not sure the right word for this – are there Star Warsians? Are there people who are tied exclusively to the Star Wars franchise?
Star Wars is – I mean, Star Trek came first, and it has its own cult following, and clearly there were Star Trek conventions and stuff.
Are you among them?
No, I am not a Star Trek fan.
Why not? What's the difference?
Clearly space fantasy and not science fiction in that realm, so I prefer Star Wars than Star Trek. But
So this is a sectarian divide in the popular culture.
Yes. But in terms of Star Wars, that fandom is huge, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger as we go from generation to generation. You know, as a
How can that be when you've had three or four? I don't know how many. I've lost track of how many Star Trek series there are, and there's about to be a new one on CBS Online. So you have all of these Star Trek movies and Star Trek TV series. Have only been what, 6 Star Wars films?
That's right.
And it's bigger. The fandom is bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's because Star Wars is really its quintessential pop mythology. And no matter if you're a fan or not, you know the quotes from the movie. You know that, you know, Darth Vader is Luke's father. You know these things. Maybe
Luke, see, there I you am go. Your father.
And I think it's really because it's such a universally appealing concept. You know, the idea of the Force being this thing that surrounds us and penetrates us. And
it's very religious,
us.
Isn't it?
It very much is. It's spiritual storytelling.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not the story of a specific culture or nationality or geography. So everybody gets to add their own layer of meaning to it.
So when moviegoers
it's
go...
It's also worth noting, too, that you don't just have the films. You have a few TV shows, and you have, you know, prior to now, 100 novels, something like that.
Wow.
You
have a ton thousands of comics.
And, you know, and the merchandising, the toys. The great thing, we were talking about the toys earlier, the reason for me that the toys were such a successful thing was film culture then was different. You had to go back to the cinema again and again, as opposed to now where you can pop it on your iTunes account and watch it really whenever you want. So if you wanted to continue the story, especially as a kid who was not really able to necessarily run to the theater, you had to continue that story with these little outreaches, these little toys, and that's how you replayed the theater of Star Wars again and again on your yard and your house and your bedroom.
From the position of literature or from storytelling, what is it about this story, Doctor, that makes it so compelling? What are people seeking when they go to see a Star Wars film, or they put it on their DVD player or download it and watch it on their device? What are they looking for?
I think you're looking for entertainment and adventure and spectacle and wonderful pop culture effects. At the same time, though, the idea of orphans looking for their fathers. I mean, we, you know, Charles Dickens is right there. The hero going on the journey, the wise mentor, again, these are all of the things that George Lucas, to some degree, cribbed from Joseph Campbell and other sources. So you've got some of that archetypal structure. I think it's dangerous to load too much literary significance onto Star Wars. Sometimes we tend to think that there's popular culture and there's high culture, there's literature and there's classical music and there's the fine art that you see in museums. And we almost tend to think as if high culture is kind of this walled fortress. And popular culture, those are the barbarian masses on the outside of the fortress trying to get through the walls. But in fact, if we look at the history of culture, that's never been the case. There's always been a lot of transaction back and forth between the things that we think are literary and the things that we think are just popular. Charles Dickens was the great entertainer of his time, Steven Spielberg of his time. Of course, Shakespeare
wrote for the pop culture of his time.
Yeah, a great popular entertainer.
Is there a difference between Shakespeare and Dickens and Hawthorne and some of the great Russian novelists like Dostoevsky and the stories they told versus the story that George Lucas and his compatriots are telling and all these book writers are telling with regard to Star Wars?
Well, they had much smaller budgets for special effects, among other things. But I think also if we're going to make any kind of distinction at all, and it's a perilous distinction and it holds up only so well between, say, literary fiction and popular fiction. And I think the only difference, and it's a really tenuous one, is maybe a greater emphasis on character over an emphasis on plot. On the other hand, the only really successful plots that involve us are ones where we care about the characters. We want Luke to understand who he is. We want Luke to come to terms with who his father really is.
When you teach books like Faulkner's work, sure, or Hemingway,
sure,
or Dickens, one presumes that the students are learning this because the academic forces that be consider this good for you. It's
sure.
Art.
Sure.
Is Star Wars art?
Yeah, of kind. Absolutely. Sure. Art is one of those terms, again, that's perilously hard to define. But sure, absolutely it is. Not all at the same level. We can look at the first two films. I'm going to call them the first two films and ignore the prequels for now. And if I want to kind of pull out some of my critical terms, they're great postmodern mashups, recycling genre elements from previous kinds of narratives and doing that in a wildly successful way. Are they art that's as resonant as James Joyce's Ulysses? Maybe not. But
and he's another one, by the way, I think, that was writing for the pop culture. And I talked to Salman Rushdie the other day at Queen's University.
Absolutely.
And his writing is full of pop culture
Absolutely,
references.
Yeah. Those barriers have utterly collapsed. And if we want to pick out a date on which they collapsed, it would be that day in 1977. When the first Star Wars movie was released.
I don't remember exactly what I thought when I saw the Star Wars film, the first one. I do remember thinking, I've never seen anything like this before. And
sure.
Darn, this is, I probably said something worse. This is really exciting. Does that film hold up? Do those first three films hold up when you look back at them from a 21st century point of view and all the films and with all the special effects that have been improved over time, thanks in large part to the work started by George Lucas and Industrial Light and Magic, etc.?
That's right.
Do they hold up?
Absolutely they hold up, and I think they hold up more now than the prequels do.
Why?
The prequels came in at a time, 1999, where George was really experimenting with new technology. Jar Jar Binks was kind of the first fully realized digital character.
People hated him. Why is that?
Well, he's very annoying.
But that's a whole show on its own, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, really without Jar Jar, we don't have Gollum in the Lord of the Rings movie. Andy Serkis doesn't become this motion capture artist who brings, you know, Caesar to life in the Planet of the Apes films and stuff. So, but in 1999, that technology was very, shaky at mm-hmm. best. And I think now we're 20 years out from that. they're not going to hold up as well as practical effects. And I think that's what J.J. Abrams and everybody on the new movie realizes as well.
Well, in that first film, they used holograms. Princess Leia appears in a hologram or someplace in the film, and that same technology—
Very small parts of the film.
Well, yes, but the same technology was used when CNN did election coverage a couple years ago. It just didn't work on CNN. I mean, it was gratuitous and silly, but it seems to work in Star Wars.
Yeah, you know, and Star Wars, the way they created all those amazing effects, it came out of struggle, you know, limited resources. Even though, you know, we consider Star Wars as a big budget blockbuster, it was made for $8 million in 1977, and the studios really didn't want to put a lot of money into it. And so those special effects were being made by kit bashing and you know, combining battleship models and stuff and filming them in a parking lot in Van Nuys somewhere. So, like, you know, that struggle breeds more creativity, I think.
How much of today's blue screen, green screen technology, which is used a lot now in movies where the actors are really just acting in front of a blue or a green wall, yeah, and there's nothing really there, how much of that really was refined, even created because of Star Wars?
Well, you know, when you get to the prequels, that's George experimenting with that technology and really taking it to the next level. He was the first person to use a digital film camera. And by the time you get to Revenge of the Sith in 2005, there was no location filming on that film at all. It was 100% green screen.
Wow.
Sound stages.
Mike on Facebook.
And in a strange way, you lose a little bit of the reality of that.
Absolutely.
But the practical effects that you see in the first couple of films, I just recently watched them again and was really struck by how powerful and how charming those practical effects are. But with practical effects, characters seem to be in real physical space. By the time you get to digital universes, you've lost that.
Mike on Facebook writes, Chuck is a game designer as well. What are his thoughts on perhaps advocating for some of his content making it into the Star Wars Battlefront video game?
Oh, do I like that? Yeah, that's amazing. I love all that cross-pollination media stuff. I love, like, planting these little seeds and seeing them sort of grow in other places.
Well, if you're a game designer, can you make that happen?
No, I don't have that kind of power. My game design was mostly pen and paper stuff, Dungeons & Dragons-y type of thing.
Okay.
So I've done some video game work, but I don't have video game work is an impenetrable wall sometimes. It's very hard to get in there.
In your book, Star Wars Aftermath, the second Death Star has been destroyed, the Emperor killed, Darth Vader is struck down, the Rebel Alliance is now a fledgling New Republic, and they're hunting down the enemy's scattered forces. Is that where, I refresh my memory, I've seen all six movies, but is that where Return of the Jedi left off, or are you adding details that were not part of the heretofore official canon?
Well, that's the sort of interesting conundrum, because Return of the Jedi ends and it's all Ewok parties and fireworks and everybody's happy. And Lucas had a darker ending for that film originally, but kind of went closer down the middle to make a more satisfying, happy ending. And so then, I'm tasked with the goal of making that happy ending, like just really tarnishing it up, just dirtying that ending up, being like, yay, the war is over, except it's really not over and actually just got a lot worse. What was once a rebellion versus an oppressive empire now has become something of a proper war between two sides that are, roughly equal at this point. So it becomes a little, less of a thrilling, happy Ewok dance party kind of ending.
When we come back, we're going to talk about tampering with the canon and what that brings out in the best of the fandom people out there. So when we come back, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Historic South End, celebrating this holiday season during Small Business Saturday, November 28th. Over 200 shops offering unique gifts for all on that holiday shopping list. Details at historicsouthend.com. And WTVI PBS Charlotte presenting Carolina Impact, highlighting a local entrepreneur making ocean water drinkable and the Southern Cupcake Queen's secret ingredient for success tonight at 8 p.m. on WTVI PBS Charlotte. New pressures on the Obama administration and Europe to rethink strategies in the fight against ISIS. On the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes, they'll be talking about how the deadly attacks in Paris ratchet up the debate over security, electronic surveillance, and coordinated military action in Syria. That starts at 10. You can join our conversation at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, on Facebook or Twitter at WFAE, and other ways as well. Figure them out. We're coming right back.
We have a day to give thanks. We have 2 days for shopping deals. And now there's a day to give back. Tuesday, December 1st is Giving Tuesday, a day to celebrate the charitable organizations that are making a difference in our shared community. This Giving Tuesday, please consider making a contribution to support WFAE at WFAE.org or by calling 704-549-9000. No matter which charity you support this Giving Tuesday, know how thankful we all are for your support of our community.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Star Wars in advance of the new Star Wars film coming out in December. We're talking about that with the author of Star Wars Aftermath, a new book in the series of Star Wars books, or Star Wars books, written by Chuck Wendig, one of our guests, who will be coming to Queen's University on the 19th of November to talk about that book at 8 o'clock. Information about that is on our website. He joins us by phone. Dr. Michael Cobry is with us in the studio, professor of literature at Queen's University of Charlotte and the former teacher of Chuck.
Right, me too.
And Adam Frazier, entertainment journalist and film critic for geeksofdoom.com. Star Trek has been known for its diversity of human characters because we had O'Hara and other people on the original Star Trek series, and it expanded out from there as the other series came on board. Star Wars is known for its diversity of non-human characters. All kinds of cosmic creatures inhabit that world. You've come under criticism, Chuck, for bringing gay characters into the story in your book. Why did you do that, and why has that garnered criticism?
Well, I did it because it's just the right thing to do. I feel like the audience out there is hugely diverse. I was at New York Comic Con recently, and a friend of mine, an artist, a comic book artist, remarked that the actual audience there at the con was way, way more diverse than the material they were asked to buy and read. And Star Wars has taken a very strong initiative, a strong foot forward to present, I think, a more accurate look and a more accurate reflection of what the audience is. And you can see that in the new film. The new film is obviously far different and far more diverse than what you see in the past, which is understandable, the past being the past. And the book does that, too. The book tries to take a very strong foot forward in that.
Well, there are female characters in this this new movie, I'm told, that are front and center. African-American characters are front and center in this. And there's been a movement on the Internet to ban the movie. because it does.
I'm sure that'll work out just fine. For
yeah. How do we interpret that, Michael? I mean, these are new characters. Why that kind of a backlash?
I think that in some fan cultures, there's a conservative element. Oddly enough, a lot of those of us who grew up as geeks and continue to be geeks always felt a sense of being outsiders. I think one of the great things about Star Wars is that it kind of made public and affirmed what had been sort of a secret language among people who were fans of popular culture in that way. But I think, particularly in the science fiction community, I'm not an expert here, that there's a little bit more of a conservative element, a faction in that fan base. And we live in a time when it's easy to stoke controversies.
You two are a self-described geek. I mean, geeksofdoom.com. I mean, what is it about being a geek that keeps women and African-Americans and gay characters out of the story?
Yeah, I just want to cut that off immediately and say that those people are not fans of Star Wars. If they are, then they've completely missed the point of these movies, which is celebrating all these differences and that there is no color or gender in space and that all these various races are equal. But these people that you're talking about in particular, they are like the Westboro Baptist Church of geeks. They are simply out there to stoke a fire and cause a controversy. And back in May when Mad Max Fury Road came out, these same geeks, I hate to even call them that, but they created a petition to boycott that movie because there was a female lead in the movie. So they're just trying to get attention in any way they
can. Is that what it is? It's just a plea for attention from people who are still...
There's,
It's Twitter outrage. That's all those guys.
Science fiction and fantasy book, and the literature section in the science fiction and fantasy has had its own issues. The Hugo Awards were recently sort of the nomination process was kind of steamrolled over by a group of people who they voted for slates, and they encouraged this sort of apolitical voting. You know, they wanted quote unquote politics out, but of course, by taking politics out of science fiction, which has always been there. They had their own strong political agenda, and it was very much against diversity. And it created a lot of complexity in how the awards worked this year, mm-hmm. and it made a very uncomfortable nomination slate.
We have had a lot of people commenting on social media as we've been talking, so let me bring in some of their comments and questions to you. Dan says, please ask your guest to discuss the role Professor Joseph Campbell played in being a consultant, helping George Lucas write the Star Wars script, reportedly copying the Bible theme of good versus evil, a theme which appeals to almost everyone and is a basic human trait for Campbell's anthropology, sociology, and psychology education and teachings after visiting native tribes all over the world, which led Campbell to develop a theory of the Bible, meaning of dying and being born again.
I'm not aware of Joseph Campbell having a personal role in influencing the Star Wars films at all. I can remember when The Empire Strikes Back was released, it was a cover story in Newsweek. Darth Vader was on the cover of Newsweek, and there was a prominent sidebar in the coverage there which was exploring the connections to Joseph W. Campbell. And I suspect, actually, it was George Lucas himself who was kind of pushing that angle of the story at that point.
He was influenced by his reading of George,
absolutely,
of Joseph,
sure,
Campbell. The New York Times says that Star Wars is all about Luke Skywalker, our hero, being on a quest, and that the story is a combination of Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which you've already talked about, and basic mythical archetypes. But you know, Dorothy was a heroine on a quest in The Wizard of Oz. Peter Pan is on a quest. E.T. was on a quest.
How John is Wayne this, and the Searchers.
How then? Why is this film so much bigger and so much more, because it's a series of films, so much more influential in the culture? Why?
For me personally, it's a story of mankind escaping their environment. And, you know, Luke Skywalker in the first movie, he's a farm boy stuck on this backwater planet.
Somewhere and, over the rainbow.
And, you know, the rest of his life doesn't look too exciting or prosperous. He's just going to take over the farm, essentially. And so when circumstances are put into place and he meets Obi-Wan, he goes off on this great adventure. I mean, for me, it was kind of this thing of, oh, you know, there's this whole world out there and I can experience it kind of thing. And I think for an entire generation, really, that, you know, we connected with that idea.
How much of it has to do with the fact that that generation in 1977 was heavily influenced by America's space program and the idea of these intergalactic worlds and flying between them was just an extension of that?
I think that was certainly something that fed into the phenomenon. I would look at other elements as well. The rising popularity of Marvel Comics, that's certainly what shaped my imagination as a kid. Many of the elements of Star Wars are drawing directly from that, including the design of Darth Vader as well. You could feel things in popular culture building. But popular culture was still a subculture until 1977. Mm-hmm. And in 1977, again, with the release of the first Star Wars movie, what had been a subculture was suddenly well on its way to becoming sort of the dominant stream in American popular culture. And I think there are also sort of profoundly American themes in Star Wars, too.
Chuck?
I think it's worth looking at the fact that it spoke to young people. And in an earnest, unironic, non-winking way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think the seeds there were planted for the popularity of young adult literature now. Like, you know, when Adam starts talking about, like, you know, where there's a boy on a planet, a dusty planet, and it looks like his future isn't great. Suddenly there's this greater world out there. That's really the heart of a lot of young adult fiction. And so I think you kind of see the bridge there.
Yeah, that's a terrific connection.
It gets better.
And
to quote a recent campaign.
And, you know, Peter Parker, Spider-Man, he lives with his aunt and uncle. Luke lives with his aunt and uncle. Harry Potter lives with his aunt and uncle. You know, right. There's an idea there that's being carried over that, like Mike was saying, about orphans and finding yourself and, your destiny, as it were.
Mm-hmm. There's also a theme, at least for Luke, probably for many of the other characters as well, of reinvention.
But if you are a kid who is born into a family and you have a mom and you have a dad and you're not living with your aunt and uncle, why is this quest for Luke to find his father, etc., so – why does it ring a bell with you? Why does it strike a nerve?
I think we all want to believe that we have a purpose. And when you first meet Luke, he's very much a person without a purpose. And I grew up in a really small town with like one red light, and we got a Walmart in 2000 or something. So like I really identify with that idea, you know, that I'm stuck in this small town. There's nothing ever exciting happens here. I'm not really destined for anything great. I'll probably work at a factory or something. But to see Luke like get beyond his circumstances, you know, like I said, I think for a lot of us it was kind of an awakening to prosper.
It's kind of an echo of the American dream, then, isn't it?
Sure, absolutely. You can
get beyond your circumstances.
You can get it's Huck Finn lighting out for the territory. Huck and Jim, not quite Luke and Chewbacca. That doesn't quite work.
Is this desire and this reflection of it in literature and popular culture and movies to get ahead of your circumstances, to find something better in the world? Is that a universal concept throughout the world, or is it particularly a Western concept?
Hard for me to say. That's outside my area of expertise. I suspect it's a universal concept, but I think it's probably built deeper into American mythology.
Yeah, we definitely have that sense that we are all the heroes of our own story, and I think Star Wars really nails that for us.
Mm. Well, most people in America walk around as though they're in a movie. The camera's just over there somewhere.
The soundtrack playing in our heads as we walk.
Exactly right. I hear John Williams. That's the soundtrack of my life. Dave on Facebook writes, in the book, Camera Politica, The Politics and Ideology of Contemporary Hollywood Film, the authors say that culture precedes politics and that Star Wars helped ease people into Reagan's own Star Wars plan, a far cry from Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, say, at the other end of the political spectrum. Have you ever heard of that notion?
I haven't heard the direct connection to the Reagan Star Wars initiative. I'm quite certain that the media advisors in the Reagan administration were aware of pillaging that title and hoping to gain some traction from that. Are there elements in Star Wars that lead to the conservatism that follows in the 1980s? Maybe only in a sense that we're moving away from the more experimental counterculture pictures that had dominated American cinema in the years before Star Wars.
Jennifer on Facebook, one point that hasn't been made is the appeal of Star Wars to young girls. Princess Leia wasn't an afterthought. She was part of the rebellion. As a young girl who was also blind in this world, she has a new way to see myself. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as a kid, I thought I watched movies like Alien and Star Wars with very strong female characters like Ripley and Princess Leia. And, you know, it's to me, I never saw Star Wars as a boys franchise. I mean, again, I got into it because my older sister gave me her toys. So I always thought it was like a very universal thing, which goes back to why I have such a issue with, you know, people having these boycotts and stuff because they've completely missed the point.
That said, it's worth noting that, like, I mean, I used to play, I had a cousin, a female cousin, and we used to play Star Wars as you did as a kid. And I got to be kind of everybody, and she got to be Princess Leia. There's essentially one primary female character in the original trilogy, which is nice to see that's, I think, being adjusted. And we're seeing a little more. The marketing has always thought to be for boys. Those toys, action figures for boys and dolls for girls. Again, that's changing. Marvel's had some issues with its marketing, but Star Wars marketing is starting to, you're seeing a lot more of the female characters get their own toys. You're seeing shirts and things, you know, aimed for young girls. I feel like those walls, they're not perfectly breaking down yet, but you're really starting to see that move.
You know, ancillary marketing around big films has become the thing that happens all the time now. But you have to remember that when this happened, it was the first time it happened. I don't recall ever going to a McDonald's before and having Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader cups and toys that you could get if you bought a Happy Meal. And that was the first time it ever happened, right?
You can trace entertainment franchises back before then. Superman, introduced in 1938, quickly franchised into toys, radio shows, lunchboxes, all of those things. But with Star Wars, and maybe just because of the increased technology and media that comes later, you can just bring that to a whole other level.
John on Facebook says, love Chuck Wendig's book, Met Him at Dragon Con this year. Some of Star Wars surviving the time has to do with an expanded universe of books that allowed it to grow as we did. We watched Luke, Han, and Leia grow up, marry, have children, and become much bigger characters. One of the things, Adam, I think that you point out, one of the reasons that Star Wars stories are so popular worldwide is that people everywhere can see the truth in them, and more importantly, they can see their truth in them, because a lot of the Force dynamics incorporate Christianity and Buddhism and Hinduism and some New Age religions. Why was that something that brings the world together as opposed to being divisive, as it sometimes is?
Well, it could play in every country with subtitles, and no one missed anything of it. Like I said, it's not a story of a particular nationality or country or geography. Putting in its space and not having an Earth and having all of these species play at a level playing field, I think, really brought people together and made it a more, welcoming environment.
In advance of The Force Awakens, the film in December, in addition to your book, Chuck, there are about 20 books coming out this fall revolving around the Star Wars saga.
Yeah.
Who reads these books? Is it adults? Is it kids?
In my experience, it's a little bit of everybody. I've gotten messages and emails from parents who've been reading them, from grandparents who've been reading them. I've seen pictures where they sent me their middle grade children or teenage kids reading these books. So that's, I think, speaks to the value of Star Wars. Star Wars is not a single generation.
And very quickly, this film that's coming out, is this going to capture the old audience or a new audience or both? Very quickly.
Both,
yes.
I've already purchased tickets, and I'm taking the day off of work, Mike. So
I read.
My kid loves it, man. My kid is in. My four-year-old is in.
That's Chuck Wendig, novelist, screenwriter, author of Star Wars Aftermath. He'll be talking about it at Queens. We have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. Dr. Michael Cobray, Dana, professor of literature at Queens University of Charlotte, and Adam Frazier, film critic for GeeksOfDoom.com.